Welcome back, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you are tuned into Asia Pacific Perspective, that video whereby every month myself and Brock West of Asia Pacific Perspective at APPerspective.net are bringing you all of the news that matters from around the entire Asia Pacific region. And for those of you not visiting APPerspective.net, once again, I would exhort you to do so. It is a great resource on this increasingly important region. Brock, thank you again for your time today. I'm looking forward to three more stories.
As always, James, it's a great pleasure. We're a week late than normal, so I hope the listeners will forgive us for that. But yeah, as always, three good stories to get into, so I'm ready when you are.
Well, why don't we just set it right up? Why don't we go straight into the first story, talking a little bit about Australian politics?
Sure. Well, over the last kind of, especially the last 2 weeks, there's been quite a bit of turmoil going on here with the leading political party here in Australia, which is the Labor Party and Julie Gillard. And we'll take this first story from the Australian, and the headline reads: Australian government to leave public in $165 billion worth of debt in this term alone. Quote, the Gillard government debt levels are forecast to blow out by 80% to $165 billion in this term alone, equal to more than $14,000 for every working Australian. Analysis of budget documents reveal that between the 2010 election and Federal Treasury's update in October last year, the 2012-13 net debt estimate rose $54 billion to $144 billion. With Treasurer Wayne Swan having junked the government's commitment to a surplus in the financial year, surprise, surprise, Bank of America Merrill Lynch now forecasts Treasury will raise the estimate by a further $21 billion in the May budget. The government is starting to develop some form when it comes to overestimating the improvement in its budget balance, Bank of America Merrill Lynch chief economist Sol Eslake said yesterday. Ahead of the budget, which comes in May here, the coalition is honing in on a number even larger than the net debt, the total value of bonds and other securities issued by the government, or gross debt, which has ballooned from $151 billion at the 2010 poll to $267 billion right now. In the last budget, the government raised the gross debt ceiling, as we've heard that recently, from $250 to $300 billion. Now, James, just and also in the related stories there, you'll see that Prime Minister Gillard makes no promises to leave superannuation untouched. So once again, unfortunately, we're seeing, you know, our political misleaders, you know, showing utter contempt and, you know, a complete lack of morality for, you know, the political system and for, you know, everyday working, not only Australians, but for, you know, for, as we've seen around the world, you know, I mean, even in Japan there, I mean, I think you guys have triple GDP debt. Is that correct?
That is, unfortunately, but I want to say welcome to the new normal, but isn't this just the logical conclusion of the old normal? This is exactly the way the system has been engineered, and this is exactly where so many different governments are arriving at the same time. So you have the debt ceiling crisis there in the United States. You have things happening here in Japan with the almost three times debt to GDP, and racking up record debts in Australia as well. And for people out there who don't know about the Australian electoral system and what was happening there recently, I understand that Julia Gillard just recently survived a leadership challenge. Why don't you tell people a little bit about that?
Well, it was kind of the challenge that wasn't really. In about October last year, former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd made a leadership challenge, which failed. This, of course, coming on the back of the successful leadership challenge that Julia Gillard herself conducted earlier in 2010, when she took over the leadership in a late-night, midnight deal that ousted then-sitting Prime Minister Kevin Rudd from his position. And only just last week, there was murmurs and rumblings that another leadership spill was on the cards because of Gillard's poor numbers here. And it came down to the day, and it ended up Kevin Rudd didn't put in a application for leadership. So it was quite a bizarre turn of events here, and this has only really opened the door for the opposition here. Now, the thing I want to point out here is that it's no surprise that the Australian Labor government here is hugely unpopular, but, you know, and now naturally as the cycle goes, the opposition is becoming more and more popular, and I really want to warn, especially Australians here, you know, this is not the solution that you know, we're just playing two-party politics here, James, and I really hope people out there are waking up to this quick smart, because, you know, we're just being led down the path to oblivion, to be perfectly honest.
Well, the two-party representative democracy system is a game of ping pong, and we're the ball, so it's not exactly a good position to be in. And give people a sense of the average Australian. What are the issues that really connect home with them? What are the things that they are outraged about with this current government?
I would definitely say the state of the health system here, especially in the state that I'm in here on the eastern side of Australia, it has significantly deteriorated, especially over the last 10 years at least, and also of course the education system. You know, so you know the normal things that we see when a governmental Western democracy system is kind of on its last legs. You know, we see the health systems failing and education systems failing, roads, transport. But of course, all the while we're still seeing massive corporate profits, bank profits, and increased government spending, which is, you know, still a major issue.
And when is the next time Australians are expected to go to the polls to vote in their next slave master?
It's due for September, and Julia Gillard herself announced the election, surprisingly, at the start of this year. So essentially we're going to have a 9 to 10 month election cycle. Lucky for us.
Well, I guess we'll have to grin and bear it and go through the motions of following the two-party political chase. But I think you're right, of course. I mean, obviously, the solution is not going to come from just choosing one or the other of the bottom-paid-for political parties. So I hope our Australian brethren will take your words to heart and consider, other ways that they can become perhaps more importantly politically active rather than simply voting for the next slave master. But let's move on to another part of the region. I understand things are heating up in Myanmar. Tell us about what's going on there.
Myanmar is a kind of overlooked nation of the Asia-Pacific, very close to China and Thailand. I mean, both of you and I will kind of plead a little bit of ignorance to geopolitical developments, but we've both kind of made a pledge to each other to keep our eye on this ever-increasing region. And one of the stories I came across came from English.cena.com, and the headline reads, "Trans-Myanmar Pipeline Gives China a Strategic Boost." Just reading here. A soon-to-be-completed gas pipeline connecting the Indian Ocean coast of Myanmar with the southwest China may help China avoid military obstacles set up by the United States. The state-owned China National Petroleum Corporation, which built the pipeline, announced on Monday that the 793-kilometre pipeline would become fully operational by May 30, less than 3 years after construction began. The schedule of the pipeline was decided at emergency Sino-Myanmar military meeting due to worsening violence between the Myanmar government and ethnic Kachin rebels in the country's north, not so far from the country's border with China. The pipeline will help free China from its dependence on the Strait of Malacca for its energy imports, giving it a shorter and alternative supply route that also helps evade military obstacles from the United States. Countries in Southeast Asia, including Myanmar, has become the centre of a silent conflict of interest between China and the US, with the latter attempting to develop its relations with those countries to restrict China's growing power. Washington has already strengthened its cooperation with India and, as we've spoken of before, has established a new military base in the Asia-Pacific region here in Australia. The new gas pipeline will reportedly be able to carry 12 billion cubic metres of gas and 22 million tonnes of imported crude oil to China every year. James, Myanmar is definitely a country that is going to play an increasingly important role as China and the US, you know, posture and maneuver their way into every corner of the Asia-Pacific here. And sadly for the people of Myanmar, their geographical location is more likely to be a disadvantage. Despite the Western media's attempt to paint Myanmar as a place of remarkable reform and progress and, you know, democracy is coming to Myanmar, I think we're definitely seeing clear signs of a major destabilisation agenda being played out here. Particularly right now, we're seeing a wave of religious violence going through the major cities, some of these of which are supporters of one of America's and the West's favourite proxies, Aung San Suu Kyi, who has pretty much stood idle by and done nothing. And of course, there's also the aforementioned ongoing conflict between the government and the Kachin rebels. This has all the hallmarks, James, honestly, of another Egypt or Libya or Syria, take your pick. But taking into account Myanmar's proximity to China and the aforementioned pipelines, I'm very curious how the new regime in Beijing is going to handle any further or future conflicts between Myanmar and also the United States. What's your thoughts?
Well, this is one of those conflicts where when you look at the map, it is so blatantly obvious what is happening here, because when you plot this new Trans-Myanmar pipeline, you look at the terminal in the west, and it's in the Rakhine province area, where there's currently, or there has been very recently, some battles between some of these Buddhist monks that are the part of the Aung San Suu Kyi faction versus some of the ethnic Muslims. Then you look at the other end of the terminal on the Chinese border, the other end of the pipeline on the Chinese border in the Kachin area, and of course you have the ethnic Kachins battling the government. You see this destabilization taking place right at the nodes of this pipeline that is being established to basically go cut right through the country and into China. So this is clearly part of a proxy war that is being waged to destabilize relations between Myanmar and China, and it does have the fingerprints of Aung San Suu Kyi, the supposed a peaceful democracy campaigner who won that wonderful Nobel Peace Prize alongside such sterling laureates as Obama and Kissinger and Al Gore. So that puts her in some pretty illustrious company, and of course she was also a finalist for the Chatham House Prize back in 2011. And for those out there who don't know, Chatham House, of course, is just the British brother organization of the Council on Foreign Relations. So she is a globalist backed puppet, and she has not spoken out against her supporters, including this monk Wirathu, who is has been imprisoned before for inciting violence against Muslims. And she hasn't spoken out against this violence that's being perpetrated by some of her followers. So it's clearly, when you go and trace this back, and I hope people will go and look at Land Destroyer Report, who again has been doing excellent work on this. But when you go and trace this back, you can literally see $2.5 million in funding came from the National Endowment for Democracy, a.k.a. the U.S. State Department, back in 2003. Up until 2004, George Soros and the Open Society Institute was funding a scholarship program which offered partial scholarships to young activists that would promise to go study abroad and then come back to their country and basically overthrow the government. So we've seen all of this for years and years. This is a globalist-backed proxy war that's shaping up here, and it's being commented on in the media by things like the International Crisis Group, which also was doing its work in Egypt and other places besides. So it's the same globalist fingerprints all over this, and it's the same agenda. It's trying to destabilize a region which is cozying up, or could potentially cozy up, to China. So I think you're exactly right. I think we have to see how Xi Jinping is going to work this particular angle, and see if he will, how he will respond to this. But I think we have to be wiser than to simply follow and swallow the line that they're feeding us, that this is all about peace, love, and democracy, when it's I think it's anything but.
It's definitely a lot more than that, and you know, the main point I wanted to get across is, you know, this is how the globalists work. You know, they're not going to be, you know, flying drones around your house tomorrow. You know, this is the way this happens. You know, they set up these proxy states, they go in, they destabilize, they gain control of, you know, resources and gain control and influence over whatever proxy dictator or government they put up. And, you know, as we've seen with Iran, they slowly but surely become completely surrounded and backed into a corner.
It's a game plan that they've been following for too long for us not to be at least wise to what's going on. So I hope people once again will check into the links we provide on this. And I know you've been posting on this quite a bit recently. So I again hope people will be checking AP Perspective on a regular basis for more about Myanmar.
Absolutely. And as you said before, definitely also check out landdestroyer.blogspot.com. Great work coming out there by Tony Cartolucci on all things Myanmar. James, we'll continue in our third story on the energy theme and the resource theme in your backyard there in Japan. And the headline reads, Japan on the cusp of energy independence. And this comes from The Diplomat. A new fire ice methane hydrate discovery off Japan's seaboard could fuel the nation's gas needs for a century. Fact or simply fantasy of policymakers? For a nation whose resource insecurity is ingrained into the national psyche, and which imports nearly all of its energy supplies, a large gas resource within reach and safe from its Asian neighbours could be nothing short of a game changer. On March 12, the Japanese government announced the research team had successfully extracted natural gas from offshore methane hydrate, the first known time anyone had achieved this feat. Previously, Japanese companies and others have tapped methane gas from onshore hydrate reserves. this is the first time it was done in, you know, deep sea offshore. Japan's government research team drilled 330 meters into the seafloor at a depth of around 1,000 meters, then decompressing and gasifying the deposits of the methane-rich gas from the Nankai Trench seabed of the Aichi and Mie prefectures. The area is believed to hold 1.1 trillion cubic meters of natural gas, equivalent to 11 years' worth of Japan's liquefied natural gas imports. According to some estimates, the waters surrounding Japan hold 7 trillion cubic meters of methane natural gas, the equivalent of a century of Japan's consumption at current levels. James, firstly, we kind of can't do this episode without speaking briefly about the second anniversary of the Tohoku and Fukushima disaster. I know there were some moderate-sized protests in Tokyo, but what was your take on the ground in Japan, nuclear-wise, anyway?
Well, certainly, I think dwindling returns in terms of the first anniversary, the second anniversary got even less play, and I assume that that things will be, you know, swept under the rug to the extent possible, and unfortunately, that's what we've seen playing out. But when it comes to the idea of energy independence, I mean, obviously, as I've been saying, this is, if there's any time at all for Japan to really work towards that, it is right now, especially when all but two of the nation's 52 nuclear reactors are offline. So the LNG, the possibility of getting gas from the ocean trenches rather than importing it is a huge possibility for that energy independence, which Japan is struggling for, and especially because it is the world's largest LNG importer, and as a result of rocketing energy prices, Japan has now had, I believe, 8 months in a row of trade deficits, which is the longest string of trade deficits it's had in the last 33 years. So it is a really important situation for Japan right now, and is part of the financial crisis that it's going through generally. But unfortunately, on the other side of that, there is a wide array of financial forces that seek to gain from having Japan in that state of dependency, and that includes the nuclear industry, which of course benefits from Japan being a net importer and having that energy reliance, and it includes other people who are part of that system, which makes it profitable for them to sell these imports to Japan, these energy imports. So it would be nice if this was able to be developed in some way, but I'm not exactly holding my breath. I think there's going to be a lot of other forces at play, and of course one of the cards that these countries love to keep up their sleeves is the idea that they need this energy, which allows them to put on the false front for why they have to fight over these deserted islands in the East China Sea, etc. So I think there's a lot of geopolitical forces also that make this type of discovery perhaps something that they won't want to develop. So we'll see if this goes the way of the other types of alternative energy ideas that we've seen, which have been suppressed because it doesn't make financial sense to the big boys.
Absolutely not. As kind of throwing our hat in the ring in terms of like a solution, I mean, I mean the first thing that comes to mind is the great work that you yourself have done on positive solutions for Japan's energy issues, and that's of course something like thorium reactors, and we'll put that in the show notes for everyone. You know, there is a real genuine solution that has been developed that has been used before, but sadly is due to the power and corruption of the global nuclear industry just doesn't seem to be gaining a lot of traction, unfortunately.
Unfortunately not, but again, why does it have to be one option? I mean, there's lots of options out there to explore. There's thorium, there's hydroelectric development that could be done here, there's fire ice, there's other options that are on the table, so I think it has to be a collection of them. But unfortunately, of course, Abe has already signaled that nuclear is going to continue to be the norm here in Japan for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, speaking of Prime Minister Abe as well, I've been keeping close tabs on what's going on with Japan and the TPP as well. Sadly, as this is a hugely secret deal, there's not a lot coming out, but I would like everyone to keep track on APPerspective.net, as I'll be trying to get as much as I can about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and also Japan's role in that.
Well, my hat's off to you for doing that. That's valuable work that almost nobody in the alternative media that I know of is really keeping track of. So I will remain glued to AP Perspective for more on that, especially. So absolutely vital information. Anything else you'd like to leave the listeners out with there with today?
No, just wish the listeners well over. We're recording this on Thursday, so it's just before the long weekend over Easter. So wish you all safe and happy holidays. And also, just before we go, James, I just wanted to give a hat tip to not only yourself, but also a word of condolences to the friends and family of Splitting the Sky. I was quite saddened and shocked to hear of his passing this week or early this week. And, you know, he's definitely one of the guys who's an inspiration not only to myself, but thousands of people out there. And I was very saddened to hear his passing, but, you know, his message definitely lives on.
Well, that's it. A loss of a powerful voice, but his message is still there with us. So I think that's what's important, and we have to take that with us while we can. So again, excellent work this month, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again next month. Once again, Brock West, APPerspective.net. Go there and study this region, and trust me, it is a fascinating region to study. So let's leave it there for now. Brock West, thank you so much for your time again today.
Always a pleasure, James. Talk to you next month. Thank you.